Move, goddammit!
The forward men of the attack force had already reached the line of trees that marked the beginning of the 200-mile pine forest, but the Mortarmen and McCaughlin were still scrambling down the bottom of the hill. There was hundreds of feet of open, rocky slope in front of them, with no place to hide.
Take cover!
Roxon pulled out his walkie-talkie.
Detroit! Detroit, this is Roxon. Everyone all right down there?
Yeah, Rock, we're in the woods. Everyone down here is okay. You heard Rock?
I'm fine. McCaughlin and Carter, some of the other guys, they're like sitting ducks. I want you to stay at the edge of the woods, but set up some fire. Make them think we've got a whole damn army down there. We've got to get those men out.
Will do, Rock.
Roxon pulled back the automatic firing lever on his liberator and rolled out from under the overhang. Roxon could see the Russian pilot and machine gunner peering down as they closed in on McCaughlin. He had no choice but to try and hit the MS-18's engine. The chopper's bullet path weaved in closer on the prone McCaughlin, who tried to hide behind a boulder no larger than he was. And he was as big as a barn door. Suddenly, one of Rock's slugs ripped through the tail rotor control. Roxon took advantage of the few seconds of confusion as the other two choppers pulled back momentarily to survey the damage. He raced down the hill to McCaughlin, hooking him beneath the arms and lifting the 300-pound man to his feet in a single motion.
Run, man! Run!
Several hundred feet away, the other men covered their escape from the dark cover of the forest. Roxon now turned his attention to the other men still trapped on the hill. He glanced up and saw the choppers hovering low over their fallen comrade, but even as he looked, they began rising and heading back to the slope. Roxon could see two figures lying prone about 150 feet away. He ran, leaping and twisting, changing direction every three steps. He wouldn't make himself a target. If they wanted to take him down, they'd have to work hard. Real hard. He ran forward to the two fallen free fighters, almost landing on what had been two of his best men just minutes before. He looked them over quickly. They were finished. No more battles for two more free Americans. Carter's head had been nearly severed from his body, the neck still pulsing out a gusher of thick red blood every few seconds from a heart that didn't even know it was dead.
Rogers had caught a stream of 9mm rounds in the chest and stomach.
His guts hung out of him like the stuffing of a slashed pillow, covering his legs and face. A puddle of blood gurgled bubbles of CO2 in the center of what had been his abdomen. As he rolled again down the hill as quick as he could move, oblivious to the sharp-edged rocks gashing his flesh, the ground where he had just been was ripped apart by the claws of 100 slivers of metal. He flew down the hill with animal speed, sliding, dodging, a bundle of pure energy. The three other free fighters, still caught in the open, were scrambling for their lives 100 yards over and down the mountain. Roxon tore to the side, hitting a slope, and letting himself spin somersaults down it. Behind him, the ground exploded into a ball of blue-orange fire. The burning, sticky gel splattered off wildly in every direction, searching for anything solid to stick to and burn. Roxon felt a sharp sting on his shoulder and ripped a piece of the flaming napalm off with his knife, flinging it to the field of rocks. Roxon stood for a split second and scanned the hill. Nord, the Swede, had been hit. He ran madly, his hair and back burning with that hideous blue flame. Two of the free fighters ran from cover and threw the burning man to the ground, slapping out the flaming jelly with their jackets. They quickly carried him off behind the trees at the very foot of the mountain. From the cover of thick aspens, Detroit Green saw Roxon was in big trouble. Rock still had a good 200 feet to go, and the choppers were coming in for the kill. He ripped two grenades from the bandolier he always wore and ran from the trees.
Rock! Dodge! Dodge him! I'm coming up with some hardball!
The short, black bulldog of a man, muscles bulging through his old army-issued blue sweatshirt, ran like a man possessed. His piston legs pumped up and down like a railroad train. Without being spotted, he pulled to within 100 feet of the MS-18s.
Rock! Get out!
Detroit dove forward as if from a diving board, praying his timing was right. Both choppers veered wildly, first away from each other, their control rudders shattered by the force of the blast, and then toward each other, two pendulums of steel death. Roczen tore down into the woods, stopping only when he felt the cool darkness surround him. He looked back through the trees. He had survived. The hill was a charnel ground, a cemetery. The Soviet air attack was wiped out, but nearly a quarter of his own men were dead. Detroit came running from a nearby gully of weeds and small stones.
All right! Check me out on that one, Roczen! Yeah!
Thanks, Detroit. I owe you.
Shit, Rock. You saved my damn ass so many times I had to stop counting. Besides, if we lost you, we wouldn't even know how to get home. You're the only one who knows these hills.
Within a minute, Rock was looking out at the edge of the woods as the other free fighters stood, heads bowed, around him.
We lost six good men today. Six free-fighting Americans. Take them to you, God, or whatever is up there above this hell. They deserve their paradise. For no finer accolade can be given a man than that he died to make his nation free.
Their faces set and drawn, the free fighters picked up handfuls of dirt from the forest floor and threw them out toward their dead fellow warriors. Then they turned as one and walked away without looking back. Dark green cumulus clouds gathered at the horizon as the ochre sun set over the snow-capped Rockies. In the thin, flickering violet air, a few hesitant stars had already appeared. A group of filthy, grime-encrusted men and women, their clothes tattered, dove into the rank pile of garbage that a Russian soldier tossed out the back window of the Stalinville officer's commissary. They grabbed handfuls of the slop, meat gristle, stale bread, and dark brown, slimy leaves of lettuce, fighting one another for what little food there was. 25 descendants of the American dream, now living in a nightmare of filth, poverty, swollen stomachs, and death. Their Soviet masters took everything of value and shipped it back to Mother Russia to feed her great armies, her empire of 40 million soldiers. The Russian kitchen man, Lieutenant Shirovsky, had been in the occupying Red Force here in America for nearly 2.5 years. He looked out of the window with disgust and amusement at the groveling American race. They seemed so primitive, so stupid. The Russian peoples were obviously superior. They had won the Great War. Now these pitiful humans were hardly worthy of the once proud name Americans. Licking their lips hungrily, they pushed against the low barbed wire fence some 6 feet from the commissary door, begging for more. Every morning, the kitchen crews would appear at the rear swing windows at the back of the fort's mess halls, and the American dregs would hungrily accept their ruler's benevolence, crowding around, scraping up every scrap. Around them, the fortress city of Stalinville came slowly to life as the morning sun pierced the strontium green-tinged clouds that flew high above the fort. The narrow, dirt-paved back streets of the American sector began bustling with activity as the gray-uniformed occupants of the ghetto made their way off to perform their menial jobs for their Russian masters. Many of them worked in the red canning factories in the southern part of the fort, the industrial sector. Others headed for the textile mills to make clothes for the Soviet troops. Everything was made for the Russians. The Americans were given the scraps, or the occasional surplus. Peddlers were opening their small businesses along the winding street that was the main shopping area for the Americans. Shops, hidden and half-submerged in doorways and basements, were selling everything from old knives and pots and pans to scraps of salvaged material for making clothing. They hawked their wares as the crowds filled the muddy streets. Russian armored vehicles stood every 5 or 6 blocks, the crews looking down contemptuously. The workers stumbled from their crumbling tenements and filed off to work. Those who didn't meet work quotas or were absent from their jobs were subject to be sent out to the fields to do what was generically called rehabilitation work. plot meant being trucked out to the surrounding countryside of Fort Stalinville. There, they would be made to rip the topsoil from the ground and pry out the boulders. The radioactive surface had to be removed so that the cleaner, pure soil below could someday be used again for agriculture. Stalinville was one of the larger Russian forts, stretching 10 miles in a roughly circular shape with an electrified wire fence surrounding the city. The Reds had split the complex into four sectors, their own totally separated and secured from the rest by special barbed wire walls and defensive systems. There was no mixing between the Americans and the occupying Russian forces. The Reds didn't dare go out into the night. The army had set up whorehouses using American women who were carefully screened, controlled, and watched. Stalinville was responsible for the 500 square mile area around what had been Omaha, Nebraska. It was a large, modern fort, one that had been built in the last 30 years, rather than at the very start of the Russian occupation. The Russians, even now, a century after the Great War, had to be on their guard against everything. They were more susceptible to radiation over here, for it was much hotter than Russia. Only a few Red cities had been struck after the sneak attack. That was one of the reasons the Russian troops had to be rotated every 3 years, before their bodies started to suffer irreversible damage. The Stalinville Soviet sector was fed its own constantly filtered air supply, pumped into every Russian room and office. Outside the Red quarters within the city, the troops would walk around with handkerchiefs around their mouths. And when out of the fort completely on missions out in the hot zones, they wore the full radiation combat gear, including face masks, oxygen packs, and heavy quilted suits. Somehow, the American free fighters seemed immune to the rads in the thin air. Stalinville was important for her KGB operations center. She was the main fort of this section of the country for the dreaded KGB blackshirts, who appeared from out of the night and dispensed death to whomever they deemed worthy. The bagman walked slowly down the long, narrow back street of Little USA. He was nearly as dirty as the street, covered with a long, flowing, once brown tweed coat, now more air than fabric, torn and bitten by fleas and mites, and coated with a layer of grease as thick as bark. The bagman's face was brown, the color of wet mud. His unkempt beard covered the lower part of his face and neck like some sort of net of filth. He slipped around the corner of the street and onto one of the main thoroughfares of the poorest area of the American sector. The bagman felt for the ice pick that he always carried, wrapped just inside one of his big flapping sleeves. He had used it already, and would again if attacked by one of the other lowlifes who existed in this ghetto jungle.
Today, children, we're going to learn about the founding of the United States.
He moved toward the voice.
The United States came about after its citizens were unhappy with how they were being treated. They were unhappy because they were being repressed.
He moved into a basement room using the shadows, the darkness, and the broken stumps of furniture as cover. In the next dank basement room, a man, a black man in a white shirt, was talking softly to eight seated boys and girls. He read from some kind of book. The bagman hid behind a rusting girder and watched. He had seen books before, but had never known what they meant. Americans were forbidden to read or learn anything by the occupying forces.
And the man who founded our country was named George Washington. In 1776, the United States of America declared itself independent from its mother country, England, and after a war and much bloodshed, found its freedom. Just as we shall, my students. Just as we someday will. Now today, we will talk about freedom, what it means, what it was like to be free.
Teacher, what is free?
Free is what you can imagine. Free is beyond what is here around you now. You must look beyond, beyond the destroyed land, beyond this fort, and see the new world that was and will be again.
But what does freedom feel like?
That's the hard part, Alex. how to imagine something in the middle of nothing. When I was younger, I was taught the books and also could not imagine beyond this fort. Till one day I saw the sky turn a perfect blue. Not with the pink rad haze or the purplish splotches like sores, but a brilliant, perfect blue. My eyes could hardly look at it, but I did. I made myself see it, and I know that this was a blue sky like they had in the old days. It had come back again, just for an hour, to show us. The Earth wants to give us back the life that was here. She is trying. And if we try too, we can build life again and live in its beauty. Now, I want to try a little exercise. Sit down, all of you.
The bagman stared from the outer room, unseen by the group. He was fascinated in spite of himself, feeling the stirrings of thoughts and feelings he hadn't known for years. He sat and watched and listened, his jaw wide open.
Now, students, today I want to try an exercise. I want you to close your eyes. Good. Now, let yourself float. Imagine you are floating higher and higher and out of the fort. You're like a cloud, just floating over everything. You can see down on the fort, and it's just a little nothing now. It can't hold you anymore. You float over the country and beyond the dust and the pink mists, and you see green. There. Do you see it? Those patches of green? Float closer. Those are trees, hills, and meadows filled with flowers and fruits, bright rainbows of color. Let yourself crumble the walls. Let yourself fly. Let yourself...
Stop!
Five figures stepped from the shadows. They wore black leather uniforms, neck to ankle, and the terrible red skull insignia on their lapels. The dreaded KGB, the Black Shirts. Their captain stepped forward, holding a 9mm Soviet Special Service revolver. He aimed it directly at the head of the teacher.
What are you doing, Blackie?
Nothing, sir.
Nothing is right. There is no factory here. No clothes machinery, no mills. There is nothing a worker would do here. So, I ask you again, what were you doing?
Sir, we were just talking about how to survive, to get food, to live in this city. I was giving them some advice about using old food and where to sleep in the cold. Just survival. We must survive.
Wrong answer. You goddamn children! Get the hell out of here! If I catch any of you doing this kind of thing again, it will be your death. Let this be your lesson for today, my young ones.
The children fled from the basement classroom, back to their shanty shacks, their subterranean refuges.
Teach them? Teach them what? They're fool. There is nothing to learn except obedience.
No!
Suddenly, the bagman charged the black shirt, 10-inch ice pick in hand.
You killed him! He was teacher! He was good! No more!
The KGB officers ran to their leader. It was over for him. His face was a ghastly pale, his mouth wrenched open in a silent scream of sheer horror. His eyes were open wide as silver dollars, the red veins almost popping out from the sockets.
I killed one. I got new one. You took my mind. But now...
The bagman's last breath left his body, and his eyes rolled up to the ceiling. Freedom was finally his. The Free Fighters marched for days through forests thick enough to provide cover from the sky. They had come the hardest route back, right through the center of the wooded region. It seemed a good idea with Russian patrols searching the entire area for them. Roxen had been through this region once before, but it had been years ago. The land was more strangely vegetated now. It seemed healthy, but the bushes and trees were different than years before. There were pinkish-tinted leaves and gray-green bark that was almost scaly, like reptilian skin. The plants and trees of the forests had finally adapted to the changed environment by changing themselves. Nothing stayed the same. Everything was evolving. Even he, Ted Roxon. People had not looked like him in the past. His body was pure steel muscle. His skin hard, almost like leather, impervious to cuts, sun, and much of the radiation of the surrounding country. He had spent his life on the radioactive plains of the USA, had wandered across her wide terrain. He had already been through a life of hardships that would have killed most men, or left them blithering idiots. He had faced exposure to the elements 2 nights after he was born, as he appeared too weak, too soft to survive. He was placed outside with only his meager wrappings into the 20 degrees below night. He survived. Then, the attack on his home by the squad of black shirts who killed his father and brothers and sisters after torturing them unmercifully, then raped and mutilated his mother. Rock had watched the horror through a knothole from his hiding place in the floor. He had memorized every one of the red murderers' faces and vowed to track them down if it took his entire life. Then the struggle across 1,000 miles of wilderness in the middle of winter to join Century City after his own village was destroyed by artillery fire. As a teenager, Rock had joined commando units attacking Russian convoys. As he grew older, he spent much of his time alone, learning the countryside and how to survive in it on nothing but his skills. He strayed away from Century City for months at a time, living in the mountains, spying on the Red Troops, entering the Russian-controlled cities and memorizing their defense, their gun emplacements, their prisons, and most of all, the headquarters of the KGB. His life was dedicated to one thing and one thing only: the destruction of the Red Armies in America. On the third day, the woods grew thinner. Fields of small, highly misshapen red and pink poppies took over the terrain. Small field creatures were plentiful here, moles and skunks, mice and chipmunks, darting from cover as the men walked near their holes and hiding places. They entered a field of black wheat, long thin stalks with purple dandelion puff seeds on the tips. The free fighters brushed against the puffs with their clothes as they walked through the waving field and freed the seeds, which flew into the air by the millions, floating violet in the evening sun.